Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill.
Okay, so today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we have Ben Falk again. And last year, we had a wonderful discussion about ponds, homesteading, permaculture, and sea berries. And you, Ben, you had just finished writing the update for the Resilient Farm and Homestead. And now the new version of the Resilient Farm and Homestead is coming out very soon. So, Ben, how are you today? How's your year been?
I'm doing good. Thanks. It's good to be back here. The year's been good. It's been busy, you know, and I'm glad the book is done. It's the process of writing that and really producing it, which is not mostly writing, actually, believe it or not. I'd say most of the time is looking for photos and editing and organizing and editing. And just a lot of organization of files. And that's, you know, that's shitty work in my mind.
Yeah, a lot.
So I don't, you know, it's not the work I want to do. I'm sure some people like it. For them, it's great work. But for me, it's not. And I'd rather be logging and doing a lot of things besides just staring at files. So I'm glad to be done with that. But I'm glad it's out there. And I think it's a really... I think it's a worthy update of the book. I feel like it's just much more mature and complete than the first book.
Yeah, it's amazing. First of all, it's an amazing book in general. There's so many insights, so much wisdom gleaned from experience, which is always really important, because a lot of people, I mean, it takes a while to really learn from your mistakes. And a lot of permaculturists have very big ideas about stuff, but then putting into practice is a whole different ball game.
Oh yeah.
And you've been putting into practice.
Yeah, I learned a lot in the second decade. So that's what is overlaid in the book, is that year 10 to 21.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing all of that work, staring at the files and everything, and for leaving us this amazing book.
Well, thanks.
I think it will come in handy for many, many people. So,
yeah.
I hope, I appreciate that. I think it will have a good shelf life. I mean, a long shelf life. It's, you know, I didn't want to, as I was doing it, I'm like, I don't want to do this again. So let's make it really what I'm going to want to be okay with sitting out there for a long time.
That's awesome. Okay, cool.
Cool.
Yeah. So today we mostly want to talk about like winter homesteading stuff and felling trees and wood stoves and things like that. But we also wanted to ask you, like, what are some of your favorite parts about living in this like climate in the Northeast? And what are some of your least favorite parts?
Yeah. Well, sure. Yeah. Well, we want to start with that. I think my favorite parts are just, it's so different every couple months, you know. I mean, especially in the winter up here, it's more than a couple months that it takes to really change a lot. I mean, winter feels like half the year sometimes, is dormant season, but, you know, a solid winter for 3 to 4 months, it's been getting less strong. I mean, definitely winter is less strong now than when I got here. Well, I've been living in this area for 25 years, but I've been living on this site for 21 years. So I'd say that how quickly everything changes, you know, when this season, all of a sudden the leaves start turning color and they fall off and you realize, oh, like, yeah, I needed a change. Like it really just resets you as a person, you know? And then, you know, it reduces stagnancy, I think, like personal stagnancy, I feel like, because everything's just constantly shifting so much. I'd say that's one of the big ones. So that's like a personal, you know, like a more of like a personal value from, you know, gleaned from, you know, stimulated and gleaned from the place changing so much. So it's such a seasonal climate.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, the summers are amazing that you can really grow a year's worth of food in the summer if you put your mind to it. You have a little bit of space and a lot of sun and some good soil. So that's the summers, right now it's winter. It was just, 0 degrees for a couple nights. So I'm kind of like, I do miss summer. I love winter, but it's easy to think the summer's really paradisical up here. It's like easy, very like meant to be lived in, you know. Winter is harsh. I mean, up here, especially, even like I have a friend, good friend Eric, he's down the Hudson Valley, and it's like just a whole different climate. I mean, he's only 3 hour drive, but it's 3.5, but it's just, we're in winter for months longer than he is, deep winter, ground's frozen, hard a lot. Under Rime in greenhouses, most plants are still going to die. It's just like a level of harshness, especially in the mountains here, down in southern Vermont or in the Champlain Valley is, a whole zone warmer. But it's harsh up here. And I think that has a lot of negatives. I mean, in that it takes a lot of energy, I mean, it's an energy intensive, place to live in that way. And that's one of the reasons I think, I can see living in a warmer climate in a lot of ways. I mean, we need to be warm. We're like hairless, furless being creatures, we're supposed, I mean, we can adapt to very like anything, but we're really evolved to be in pretty hot places as a species. As far as like our hardware, I mean, with technology, even primitive technology, we can make a go of it in the Arctic, but it just takes so much work. And so I think that's one challenge with being up here. I mean, I've cut and split wood now, way well over 20 years for all of our heat. And it's like, that's a big job every single year, to just burn up that work, And I know in certain, the grass is always greener in certain climates, like you can't store food very well. And there is kind of a dormant season and you still can't store anything without like active refrigeration. And here we can passively cool very easily with root cellars and store very well. But it takes a lot of energy, especially like modern, I mean, modern lifestyles where how most folks are living is like just burning through, thousands of gallons of fossil fuel every winter to heat their homes, and just feels very energy intensive.
Yeah. And we're kind of not we, people who are using all the energy to heat their homes in the winter, like they're not going out there and felling the trees and splitting the wood. So it's kind of hard to really know how much energy is being put into just staying warm.
And when you do it yourself, like every few sticks you throw in the fire, that's that's your time, to go get it and harvest it and process all of it, carry it a couple of times. And
Yeah,
so yeah, so like the I think I say in my book that Robert Frost from may probably had his wood delivered and maybe even stacked because he said it only warmed him twice, or maybe that was Thoreau, I don't know, one of those guys, said wood warms you tw warms you twice, once when you split it and once when you burn it. But there's also harvesting, there's also hauling, there's also carrying at least twice and then burning it, so there's like 5 to 7 times depending on how you do it.
true. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just very labor intensive, and it's not for everyone. I do love it. I mean, I love the snow. I love to ski. I love the quietude of winter. It's really magical, but it's also, super harsh. It's not if you're out in it and you're unprepared or something goes wrong, like you're going to be dead before morning. On most nights around here, it's like it's going to take you. The cold is not friendly in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, you
So
could literally die if you're not prepared.
you
Goes
you
wrong, yeah.
fall in the water, you're
Yeah.
very easy. So the warmth is a certain hospitableness to warmth. And
So it also one of the things I really like about the book and the updated book is the information you put into wood heat and the stoves and felling wood, because that's such a crucial part of living in a cold climate. And also so important to utilize as much of the energy that you're burning as possible, because you don't want to just waste energy. And so that's like the efficiency of your stove, the efficiency of your house, all these things are intertwined and important. So what kind of stove are you burning, and how do you glean the most energy from it?
Great question. So, I've just had so many versions of these systems. So right now I'm sitting in our kind of office studio apartment, and this is our first version of the system. And I'm actually going to turn this down because I just started this like half hour ago, and it was turned up too much. And as you can see, so now it's dialed down a little. Maybe I should just close the damper. So, there, right about there. So this is our first version of our wood stove. Well, I've heated with wood for many years before getting this, but this is the first time I wanted to put all the yields together. So it heats our hot water. As you can see, the water tank up there, because I see that as just essential. I mean, you can live without hot water. I mean, more power to you if you do. But I like a hot shower, and most of us, really consider hot water pretty essential. And so that's a key yield. So this is a thermosiphon, looping from the tank into the firebox and out, and with a water jacket, pretty standard like wood stove hot water setup. And it's a cook stove, so you can bake in it, you cook on it, has cooking, baking, space heat, hot water, and also even firelight. It's a hearth, it's
Really
a
cool.
nice to hang out in
Yeah.
by. So all those yields are put together, and to me that's like essential. Like, what now? I would never live in a house with just a wood stove. Like, it would be, to me it's like it should be a cook stove and it should heat your hot water, because we all cook, we all bake, and for the most part we all want hot water pretty much, and we all need to definitely heat our place. So to me it's just like baseline. Like, it's as important. I mean, it's, in a lot of ways, it's more important than a garden, because you gotta be warm and you're gonna cook pretty much. So yeah, I so to me it's amazing that, like, really almost no one has these systems, but I think we all should. Now I've done a lot of different versions since then. So this I set up like 12 years ago, 15 years ago. And it's just a $600 Waterford Stanley stove that needed some work. I didn't know how this would work very well, so I didn't want to spend, lots of money. The tank I got for free. It's just an electric tank my neighbor was getting rid of because he was sick of paying for an electric hot water heater. It's like a five, I think there's two 5,000 watt elements in it. Like, it was like 10,000 watts when it was, plugged in, like crazy electric use, but it didn't leak. So he's like, hey, you can have it, I just don't want the electric, I don't want to heat with electricity anymore, my hot water. So I'm just using it as a passive tank, no electricity, and it's where my hot water goes. It's 40 gallons. Since we've done this setup, I've done like four more versions, and they mostly have 50-gallon tanks, which I've learned is even better than a 40-gallon tank. And now the latest one I did is a very high efficiency cook stove called made by a company called J.A. Roby in Quebec, and it's uses like a third less wood than this for more heat, even more heat. And the coals last, I mean, we could go away for 2 days and come back, and there's basically still an inch of hot coals after like 18 to 24 hours.
How?
It's just a really airtight stove.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it just builds up a coal bed, and like, we can go away in the morning, go away all day, come back in the evening and throw a few logs of dry wood on it and just get the air supply up, 10 minutes, close the air supply. That's it. It's going. It's like back up to speed versus like, build. I mean, this, we have to build a few fires a day in this.
Yeah.
you know, pretty much like kindling and all, you know, like making many, many fires. So it's amazing. We burn like, we basically barely use any kindling now. You know, there's just like, you know, you don't, you, a lot of us need a lot of kindling. If you're having a fire in a wood stove, you're going to make a lot of fires. But not if you have these really high efficiency, super airtight stoves. So that one is a big improvement. That's like, I'm calling like version 4.5, 4.6, because I've done like four different main stoves and then I've had tweaks of each one. And yeah, that one I've learned more in the last version than I have in all of them, really, even combined. I mean, I just did a lot of tweaking. I no longer use a water jacket. All the water's heated on the outside of the stove with copper, and it doesn't take that the advantage of that is you don't take heat out of the firebox. You don't want to suck heat out of the firebox, because most of your, a lot of your heat comes from the gases, which only burn at 1,000 Fahrenheit. So you want the hottest firebox possible.
Uh-huh. Right.
That's why all the modern stoves have very insulated fireboxes. And they may feel not good to old timers, because an old timer might go up to them and be like, oh, this isn't even hot on one side. And it's like, yeah, the heat's going to come out the top. It's going to come out somewhere else. You just don't want heat coming out all sides of the stove, or the firebox isn't hot. So then you're immediately cutting out like half your heat to begin with, your potential heat.
Right.
Right.
Even though having a fire in like what, say like a tin box seems like a good idea because the heat's coming out on all sides.
Yeah.
It seems like, oh, that's great, I'm getting a lot of heat. But immediately you're working with half the available BTUs if you do that.
So the fire isn't burning as efficiently, and then so it's not consuming all of the gases.
Exactly. And so all the new stoves now have these gas reburn, like these tubes in the top. And if you don't see these stainless steel tubes in the top of your stove firebox, I just wouldn't even buy it, because you could buy old stoves. This was $600. You can buy old Vermont casting stoves. I have two of them, Vigilance, for $400. They work good. But compared to a new stove, a modern stove, you're really working with half your BTUs of the wood. So immediately you got to burn twice as much wood, which is a lot.
Yeah.
Now those new stoves aren't cheap. I mean, our new J.A. Roby stove was like $4,500.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, if it was $9,000, it would still be completely worth it.
Yeah, totally.
Because you just are cutting, you're cutting like half your wood, like almost half your wood every year forever. I mean, like compound that out 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, count time, count money if you're buying this wood, count your time loading the stove, not just processing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, honestly, like if we paid the value for something like that, like it should be $20,000, you know?
Yeah, right.
Compared to what people spend 20 grand on a piece of crap car nowadays, you know, like it's actually like a steal. So, I mean, it's really, really worth its value. So yeah, we have a wood stove online. I've started to roll out some online courses in the last couple of years, especially since we talked like a year ago or so. And our latest one is all about a deep dive on that latest system that we did.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And it's on our website. You can see the whole Zoom session we did live. It's all recorded. And it basically tell you what you need to know to do it. And honestly, to me, it's like the lowest hanging fruit. It's like, have a high efficiency wood cook stove, heat the water with it outside the stove, so you're not sucking the firebox heat out. Send it to a 50-gallon plus tank and have free hot water.
Yeah. And so that water tank is then also serving as mass.
Yeah, it's a nice piece of mass in the house too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people getting into permaculture, they immediately they're thinking rocket mass heater.
Yeah.
That's what they can do. So but why this system over a mass heater?
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a great question. I certainly you know, got very enamored with mass heaters, rocket mass heaters, and masonry ovens when I was reading about them 25 years ago in college. And because they are, and I have a good friend, an old friend who for a while built masonry heaters professionally. So I got to know them a bit. I worked with some clients who put in masonry heaters. here's the long short of it is mass space heaters are super efficient. Rocket mass heater, masonry ovens, they are more efficient than even the best wood stove. And so, but I still wouldn't use one. And here's why. Because efficiency is only one value.
Yeah. Right.
And that's great. I mean, I wish these were as efficient. It's there's no problem with that. That's good. Yeah. The more they're, and when I say efficient, I mean at getting, extracting heat from a given amount of wood. You have 100 pounds of wood, you get X amount of BTUs out of it. A mass-based heater, as far as I know, is going to get more out of it than a wood stove. The best, even the best wood stoves. The problem is you burn them once or twice a day, super hot, brief burn. That's the use pattern. And the reality is that you just can't put a lot of that heat in water when you burn it so briefly.
Yeah.
It takes like hours of heat to transfer a meaningful amount of water to the tank. You can get a lot of water and heat pretty quickly with like on-demand hot water heaters, but with it doing that has a pump, there's pressure in there. With a passive thermosiphon, it just doesn't seem basically physically possible to get that much heat in the water that quick. So there may be some people who will argue with me on this, but I've asked some of the leading masonry heater people in the country about this. Can you heat hot water? Can you make hot water with your masonry oven? And the best answer, the most optimistic answer I've got from people is that, yeah, we can make some hot water. And I say, well, how much? And they're like, you know, enough for like dishes or a shower. But we do 3 showers, dishes, laundry. You know, we have a 6-year-old. My wife does a lot of laundry.
Yeah.
I think she does more than is necessary, but that's just between her and I. But we do a lot of water. We live like, we're not that frugal with our hot water at all. With our hot water, we're actually pretty flagrant with our usage. And we get enough hot water.
Yeah.
So we get like, our 50 gallon tank in our house right now is 160 degrees at the top and 140 at the bottom. And that's 50 gallons of water. So I don't know if you're familiar with how, you know, with water tanks, but that's a shit ton of hot water. That's like, because that's, you only need 120 degree water to do dishes and do showers. Mm-hmm. So that's more than 50 gallons of 120 degree water.
Wow.
Right, because it's being mixed with cold water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's like 80 gallons of, you know, showers, dishes, laundry, baths.
Right.
So it makes a lot of hot water. And a masonry oven. So you get back to that masonry oven, rocket mass heater. I have yet to see a system that makes much at all. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing is cooking and baking. If it's only hot for like an hour twice a day max, I know people bake in masonry ovens, but it's like brief. Mm-hmm. And then how are you gonna make a soup, like an all day soup, chaga tea? Like we're always like nettle tea. We've got like nettle and chaga on our stove now up there, and
yeah,
a chicken in the oven that's going for 3 hours.
Yeah.
So efficiency, you know, great, but it's not as effective to meet the needs that we have.
Right. So you're obtaining more yields using a wood stove like that.
And maybe if we were just comparing apples to apples for space heating, we might burn, let's say, half a cord more, quarter cord more than the masonry would be if this was a masonry heater.
Oh.
But we wouldn't get cooking. We wouldn't get baking. We wouldn't get hot water. So that's great. Take my half a cord. You know, I want other things. Yeah, that's kind of what I figured. Also, I mean, well, rocket mass heaters are pretty cheap, but a big on full-on masonry oven could be like a very high capital investment.
Yeah.
Even if you build it yourself.
Right.
Don't get me wrong, super beautiful. Do you see that matrix? There's that matrix in the new book that chart choose between a wood heating options.
I love that.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, and so that one, you know, that helps articulate some of what I'm saying too.
And you had like a little bit of snark in there, which I love. Like, oh yeah. Like instead of just yes, you're like, oh yeah.
Well, you know, with a masonry oven, like that was, about the hearth. And like, yes, just wasn't strong enough. Like a masonry oven is like, that is the definition of a badass hearth.
Yes. And we know some people who have like their masonry heater, like they're able to build their own house, right? So they have their masonry heater in front of windows, so the windows, south-facing windows, and they're heating that mass
From the
whenever from the sun. So it's
sunlight.
like using multiple, it's multifunctional in that way. And it is very effective, efficient. The other thing that is nice about like the rocket mass heater and so on is you can do more coppice, like smaller caliper wool. And so like, which is another issue is like, it takes 30 years for a tree to grow and a season for you to, a couple of weeks, even a couple of days for you to burn it.
Yeah, or an hour. Yeah. We're about to be on our first coppice rotation of black locusts here. So I've planted hundreds of locusts. I'm looking out the window at some of them here on 10 acres. And we're at 12 to 18 years in, depending on when I planted those. And they're all like here to like here.
Nice, yeah.
And so we're gonna, we'll probably, and then they'll probably regrow to that size in shorter because they have a whole root system now. So maybe they'll be back at that in 10 or 12 years. So it's gonna be interesting to integrate those into the wood cook stove system. I mean, it's black locust, so I think it's not gonna be a surprise. It's gonna work really, really well, I think. I think they're not gonna dry very well if I don't split them. So I'm waiting till they get big enough to at least reasonably split them in half.
Yeah, and so for those of us who don't know, black locust is one of the highest BTU woods, and it's also one of the fastest growing woods, which is a really nice combination
Yeah,
because.
and a very unusual. I mean, it's an exceptional combination.
And for posts, it lasts a long time. Once you take that like outer bark off, it's a nice hardwood, and some people use them for fence posts.
They say the heartwood will last outlive cedar rails as posts in the ground. So yeah, super high, top of the list BTU per cord, like up there with hickory, hop hornbeam, white oak. Oh, maybe Osage orange is a little bit higher.
Yeah, and I guess Osage orange is another one of those that grows fast and that you can coppice, because that's the nice thing about these trees is being able to coppice them and then them growing
That
back
is
twice
cool.
as fast.
Yeah, the thing is, the interesting thing is all hardwoods pretty much coppice. So that's they all re you know they all resprout. I mean, we sometimes get people in other climates or who don't know, and they're like, well, so you cut that big tree down and then there's just that one less tree in the woods, and without having managed forest done forest management, they don't realize, like, okay, you take that tree down and there's 20 trees that get sunlight that you're growing, so the idea of removing a tree from the landscape, if it's not a piece of old growth, don't get me wrong, or some rare tree, it's we kind of, I think, need to accept that there's nothing degenerative about that action in of itself. And there's a lot of things that might be actually regenerative about it. No, don't get me wrong, if it's an ancient tree or a mother tree in the landscape, like for sure, that's not true. But the fastest carbon, the most carbon's being taken up per unit time in a woods that's mid-succession.
So you want to manage it so you're having the most growth possible.
Yeah, if you're really trying to leverage the sun's energy the most, which ultimately we're in the business of doing, if we're into sustainable living, sustainable energy use, regeneration, we're trying to get as much value out of the sun as possible, out of the sunlight falling on the ground. We're essentially like solar energy, managers. We're managing for a mid-succession to do that. And we're not trying to manage just for old growth to do that, although we want to do that for diversity's sake and for other reasons, and we're not trying to have just, a very, very young forest either.
Yeah, the forestry management, it is really all about the management, because the problem is when people like clear cut stuff or like overcut, but when you're managing it in a healthy way, then you're actually increasing the amount of energy that the forest can produce.
Can capture, yeah, and store.
So what are some other like tips for forestry management and woodlot management from your perspective?
Yeah, well, So we have our second site that we manage, and I do all my I log here too, but I've been logging over about 50 acres on that site for 11 years, and I just thin. So it's just like thinning in a veggie garden, but with a chainsaw, and managing sunlight at a larger scale. But I mean, you're really doing that in the garden too. So I'm always looking towards what am I promoting. So like, in some ways, it's the same way when you ski through the woods, you don't look at the trees or you'll hit the trees. You know, you look at the space between the trees. I'm looking at the trees I want to keep, not the trees I want to harvest. Yeah, so a lot of people think, oh, go in the woods, you look at the trees you want to take out for your wood. Like, no, I'm pretty much looking at what are my keeper trees.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a sweet tree that has a great growth form. It's going to live a long time. Doesn't have a big, crotch up at 20 feet that's going to rot out. It looks really healthy. It's not diseased. Doesn't have big damage to the base or somewhere up from a storm. So, and then I look around, okay, what's competing with that tree? How can I release it? If it's a younger tree, how can I make sure it keeps having room to grow if it's a mid-sized tree? And so then I'm just going to cut around it. And whatever those trees basically need is what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to end up with what remains, which is red maple. If I'm luckier, I mean, red maple is not my favorite firewood, but it's kind of what my land has to offer in order to treat the land as best as possible. I've done that. Finally, after about 7 or 8 years, I got through most of the red maple need to pull out of the woods. And that's nice because now I can pull some yellow birch, beech, sugar maple, the odd hop hornbeam, which is obviously much nicer firewood than red maple. It's just like 50-70% more heat in it.
Yeah. So are you looking at the species too that you're trying to promote? So are you trying to promote more?
Yeah.
Like do you have oaks or what species?
Yeah, you kind of have like management goals for like what is most important for you to promote and for me and why. For me, if it has a nut yield, I'm going to promote it because there's almost none in the woods. Now we've planted thousands of nuts in a 15 acre open land field edges, but in our woods we have in the Green Mountains, there's essentially no oak basically. So our biggest nut yield, our most significant nut yield is beech, which is, you know, a minimal nut, but I'll promote that just because, and I'm also going to promote what's underrepresented. So essentially I'm just going to manage for diversity, for wildlife value. So yellow birch, I'm really not going to cut much because we don't have a lot. Red maple, super abundant. It's easier to say, okay, let's burn that. And I'm really just also managing too for saw logs. So for the straightest boles, the trunks, so it will be a valuable saw log down the road. Those are kind of how I get my management objectives. And then, but when it comes down to the rubber meets the road, a lot of it's also going to be what can I cut that I'm not going to destroy a lot of nice trees by dropping.
Because
you wreck a lot of crop trees when you fell a tree.
Crop tree meaning you sell it to a sawmill or?
No, just like the tree, your trees you want to grow and not destroy.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The future crop.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's it, you know, in a lot of ways, that's really the practical challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it makes sense to be cutting more like smaller, medium sized trees than like the big.
Yeah.
And create a lot of damage
for me. In a lot of our woods it's going to be cutting like 10 to 18 inch trees, which in some places are big trees and in some places are not, but
yeah. And it's also maybe a lot safer to cut smaller trees than the bigger trees, and that's an issue you talk about in the book too. You say that the chainsaw is one of the most important tools that you can have on a homestead, but it's also one of the most dangerous.
Yeah, it's probably about the only tool I wouldn't advise, you know, just go learn how to use it yourself. Like a lot of tools you can really learn, just get the tool and just, you know, start working with it. But with a chainsaw, I would take the game of logging course if you're in the northeastern US, or seek out some really good training if you're somewhere else, which can be hard to find because a lot of people, even who are loggers, are usually a professional logger is going to be doing a pretty darn good job of it. If they've been doing it a while, but there's a lot of yahoos out there, and I'd say your average person using a chainsaw is not felling trees in a really safe way, or bucking, or you know. So you really do want to get some good training for it. Apparently, you can't buy a chainsaw without like a license in parts of Europe.
Oh wow, interesting.
Yeah, like you just can't go get a chainsaw because you know they're like gonna pay for your medical bills if you hurt yourself, and they're like,
hey,
if we don't want you cutting your leg off right now.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you can literally die. You can like cut your like an artery or something, or
I mean, split second, you can cause a mortal wound for sure. It's just such a, you know, bare, most aggressive, you know, cutting implement like in most people's shop, and it doesn't work to have it in a safety. Like it has to be just a bare chain, you know. No. So,
yeah, it's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, you just can't you can't have a moment lapse when you use it, which is why I like logging and firewood work. It's like you just have to be 100% present. It's like, you know, when I used to rock climb a lot, you just
It is.
You have plenty. It's like cheating meditation, you know. It makes you meditate. It makes you be present because you the consequence is so obvious.
Yeah, high intensity, definitely.
Yeah,
I'm doing the chainsaw work out. We have this old apple orchard, and there are all these young ashes growing up through. So I'm trying to rehabilitate the apples and cut firewood. Most of them are pretty small, so it's not too dangerous. But it's like every time I go out there, I'm like it's like a very high intensity situation.
Yeah, you really. I find cutting small stuff, especially slash dealing with branch wood, is definitely more dangerous than dealing with the big stuff.
Okay.
Because it will often get caught and like kick, and like the branch wood, like you fall, you like get tripped by branch wood.
Yeah.
Like if you have a big, nice hunk of maple, whatever it is, big 18 inch log on the ground, you're bucking. Like that's as safe as it gets. Keep your feet out of the way. Felling, obviously another danger, but if you're like, got slash on the ground and you're cutting branches, like that's the only time I've ever really almost hurt myself really badly.
So what is, for people who have never like gone and cut down any trees, can you describe like a little bit more about the process? Like when are you doing this, or like as far as time of year? It's obviously like winter, but like maybe why, and like what kind of equipment and like safety gear you're doing, and like what is your day out into the woods?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always trying to go in ideally the early winter before you. I want to not get near the sap rise, you know, when the sap rises, moisture is up in the tree. So you want the driest wood possible, and you want frozen ground. Mm-hmm. For us, those usually line up in November or December. This year they didn't because it was pretty warm late. Actually, last few winters there's been a lot of hard logging seasons. So I want frozen ground with as little snow as possible. Snow is just work, and I have to freeze in the roads. You have to like drive on them and then let them freeze because the snow insulates the ground. So I want insulated grounds, hard ground, so I can drive easily with my tractor. I use a 56 horsepower tractor and a logging winch, like a 7,000, I think it's like rated at 7,000 or 8,000 pound, the logging winch. So I can pull like more weight than the tractor. I can probably pull like a cord out at once if the conditions are good. You winch it up with a cable and chains, and then you chain them to the back of the logging winch, and you lift up the logging winch and you drive out
the whole log.
You can drive like 30 foot long logs. And if it's really hard, nice ground, I can drive like a lot of weight out. If it's like deep snow, I mean, you could cut what you're hauling out by like, you know, 80%, 90% and take like one or two sticks. And I don't want to rip up the ground. You know, I want to go in where I logged, and in the spring, couldn't see no evidence of me logging except some sawdust, you know, next to stumps. And I do that. I basically never see tire tracks in the woods, you know, from my logging. And that's a good goal. Now, if you're commercially logging, you can't afford that because you got to work, you know, you're under the gun.
Right.
But for me logging my own land, that's mm-hmm. what I'm doing. And I'm always able to do that basically. And then I'm looking to not log near the full moon when there's more moisture up in the trees. You know, I haven't measured that, but it seems to be the case.
Interesting.
from lots of cultural knowledge and also just from the tide, you know, tides pull water. So you could say the new moon would pull water up too, but my sense from looking into it in different cultures is that you would always take wood in the new moon, leading up to the new moon and just after the new moon, and being away from a big moon and especially a waxing big moon, but definitely away from the rising sap. So cold, the colder, the better.
Yeah.
You know, I think bare ground, December, January, February, whenever it is. But then, you know, come February, March, for us, the sap might start rising.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's pretty much how I'm doing it. And I'm trying to get everything bucked and split and stacked by, you know, end of April and undercover to dry firewood.
So how much wood are you typically?
Well, our newest system is going to burn less than 2 cords to get all our hot water and all our space heat, plus, you know, lots of our cooking and baking for the whole year.
Yeah.
For the whole winter, it's infinitely less wood than even like 5 cords, because even if you have 5 cords, that's 3 more cords per year. So that's 30 more cords in 10 years. You know, it's like a monthly bill, you know, it's like it's happening every year. So it's like, that's only whatever a month, but okay, times it by, you know, you get a multiplier there. So yeah, two cords, but I also cut for one rental and another building. So like I am processing, you know, 5 to 7 cords.
Okay.
But one building is only, you know, our house is only needs 2 cords.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I imagine your house is well insulated as well.
No. Well, the house that we live in mostly was on the property. So it's actually got a lot of glass, and no, it's not very well insulated. The studio I'm in now on this stove, which isn't even very efficient, would get us through a lot of winters on 1.5 cords.
Nice.
Wow.
But we built this and it's well insulated. Yeah. Once you start flirting with like about 2.5 cords or less, though, I wouldn't go crazy. Like to save another 0.5 cord gets very low, very minimal gain.
Hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
So the main thing is getting that wood stove efficient and using as much of the heat as possible from it.
I would say that's start. And then, you know, definitely weatherize your house, keep the heat in as much as you can. If you can build a small, well-insulated house, man, more power to you. You're just going to cut your need for everything so much less. But yeah, and then thermal mass, you know, the more mass you have in the house, the better.
Yeah, I mean, that's the case for a lot of, I mean, like for us, like this house was built in stages over 100 years, probably starting in the 1800s, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like everything's a little wonky, and, you know, like we're not starting from a fresh build, and you can do a lot more if you're having a fresh build and you have the mass in the right places, the insulation in the right places, the windows. But retrofitting a house takes a lot more work in a certain way. And you got to.
It's so hard. And for retrofitting, I mean, weatherization is often the lowest hanging fruit. Just seal, just do air sealing.
Yeah.
Find the gaps, go out and go around with, lick the back of your hand, the back of your fingers, and go feel for the drafts. Like the last few nights when it's super cold, you'll just find them all.
Yeah.
Or get an infrared, you know, if you can get, sometimes the towns have it for free, or the county, you can get an infrared scan of your house from outside and just see the places to be like, all right, we need to insulate that corner up by the roof. That's a typical spot. Open that up in the summer, keep the photo, and let's like jam cellulose in there. Those are low hanging fruits, but re-insulating a whole house is like often just not realistic.
I mean,
you got to take off the whole outside or the whole inside usually.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's like, you might as well almost build a new, I mean,
yeah.
you're in it. You're in it deep to do that. And you know, if you're not doing it yourself, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars.
True.
And then the other thing is, if it's a big house, is just closing areas off. Just try not to heat whole parts of your house in the winter, especially when it's a cold snap. Just say, you know, if you can have coolant in the radiator, if there's radiators in the baseboards, or if there's no heater in there, just close it off.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
And the other thing in setting up your home and the systems in your home, in the book, you also talk about like where you're putting your hot water heater, like the water tank.
Yeah.
And these kind of things. So, and you say, you know, third floor is the best, whereas most people have their hot water heater in their basement.
Yeah.
Pump it.
Yeah. It's definitely nice to be able to have, if you want to heat hot water with your stove, you need that hot water tank above it, or it could be a floor above too.
Mm-hmm.
In our house, this tank is one floor above.
Cool.
And then ideally you have another tank, which is shown in my book, above that. So on the third floor of this building is a tractor supply plastic tank that I flip one ball valve. And when the well is down or the grid's down, I can flip a ball valve and I have gravity feed. The whole system's gravity fed from that tank.
That's awesome.
So we have hot showers. If the grid's down for a week or a month or 5 years, you know, there's hot showers as long as we can feed wood into this stove.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's literally running hot water. So that's, you know, that's serious resiliency in a very baseline system.
Yeah.
But none of that is high tech and it's all super cheap. I mean, you just put one of the buildings we did, we bought like a $140 brew kettle. It's like a 20 liter brew kettle.
Mm-hmm.
It's stainless. And, you know, I just fill that and that can back pressure the whole system.
Sweet.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And if you have a spring up on the hill pressurizing your whole house, well, that's the holy grail. But most of us, you know, I don't have that set up here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most people have well heads. And you also say it's better to have two wells than one. Is that?
Well, that's true. But I don't think I say that because that's expensive. Two well lines?
Well lines. Yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Two wells would be.
Now you have to drill two wells.
If you're going to build from scratch and you're spending as much money as you spend on a new house, I would put 2 3/4 1 inch well water lines in the ground, because when that goes bad or breaks, you know, that can be like $50, you know, to just add that in.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had to, at a previous house, we had to dig up the well line. Because it had gone, it was leaking and we didn't have water.
Yeah. It took me years to realize my well line here was leaking.
Oh, wow.
I actually thought I had an artesian spring below the well head. Well, if you ever you have a spring and it's in the vicinity of your well, turn the power off and wait a few days and then decide if you still have a spring.
Gotcha.
That's what happened, was this power went out in the summer, which is when I would notice this flow of water. And it was out for like a day and I walked by the well and my artesian well, which always flowed, was not happening. And it was instant. I was like, oh shit, that's not a spring. My well head leaks. And when we fixed it, the power bill went down $5 a month.
Wow.
It was pumping more than it needed to.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, I mean, I guess I could have figured that out. And it was like that when I bought the place. And she was like, and I think it was like the woman was like, yeah, it's a spring. And, you know, you're just like, oh, that's the story.
Yeah. Totally.
It becomes truth in your mind. And absolutely. It's like, no, there was no spring there. And I, instead of finding this, I didn't even look for the leak, because I just put a new line in, because to dig it up, I would damage it, you know? So it's just like, put a whole new line in. And actually there was nice walnuts planted above that area. So I was like, let's just put a whole new line in.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's when I put a second line in. So we put in line 2 and 3 at that point.
If you're going to put one line in, might as well put two.
So it's just, the second line is just a backup for if the first.
Yeah, just stop it all. Just cover it with tape or an end cap in the house and bring it up next to the well. So if and when that goes bad, you might at most have to dig down to your pitless next to your well, hook that up.
Mm-hmm.
Hook it up back in the house, boom. No excavator has to come to your property.
That's smart. I like that. Definitely.
I mean, for the cost of poly line, you know.
Yeah. Right.
When I had some friends years ago, they're buying Bitcoin, and I bought extra rolls of poly tubing, and I bought an extra, had a little money on hand, I bought an extra chainsaw. I'm like, that's my Bitcoin. It's
right.
Water pipe, spare chainsaw.
Yeah.
Some more 22 ammo, you know.
You're good.
That's going to gain value.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, get a stove, one of those really high.
Get
high
another one.
Efficiency stoves.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So speaking of like these water systems, you also have in the book, this really interesting one that kind of blew my mind, of a compost hot water heating system where you're using a huge pile of wood debris circled by hay bales to, you know, have a water pipe coiled in it and then run water out, and you're getting
the Jean Payne mound.
The Jean Payne mound. Yeah. So you actually tried that. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about your experience and what you learned.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, the Jean Pain Mound was a really neat experiment, and like a lot of things, it sounds amazing, and you know, just like why wouldn't you do that? And then when you do it, you realize, okay, there are some reasons that not everyone's doing this. Although I think there's some really good applications for it. I realized that ours wasn't I don't think a good context for that system. The challenge, well, there's kind of two things. One challenge is that I realized I didn't need heat in the greenhouse. Heating the floor, the soil with 400 feet of tubing or 800 feet of tubing, it didn't help the plants grow really. Like in for us in the mountains here of New England, there's just not enough light. Like the days are too short, it's super cloudy. It doesn't matter. I could heat it all I wanted, and like it's not getting me anywhere. There's not enough light. And I'm not gonna like light up my greenhouse to grow kale and chard, you know, to have a little more kale and chard in the winter. So I really realized, like, oh, I don't need the heat. And I actually also figured that by running a wood stove and throwing a cord of wood through it one winter to just grow all winter. And it was like, no, it didn't really, because it's at night, it still gets freezing cold. I'm not going to walk out to the greenhouse and start feeding it all night for greens because it's all glass. So it's just losing heat super rapidly. So it's like, okay, I don't need to heat a wood stove. I'm not lacking heat. And so I don't have that need to begin with. And then if you're going to make compost, which we all should do, well, that's a lot more work to make compost with tubing in it. Because then when you pull it apart, you got all that tubing like spaghetti, and you don't want to damage all that nice tubing. So,
Pitchforking and trying to avoid it.
yeah. And I knew when I was laying it in, I was like, this is going to be a pain to get apart. But I was like, oh no, this is so cool. We got to do this. And I had a friend working with me. And then it was such a pain to pull apart. And we did damage some of the tubing because we got a little impatient, and I used the tractor a little more aggressively than I probably should have, because I'm like, you know, there's 10 yards of compost here. I don't want it in the middle of my driveway. It's spring now. We're like done with this. It did compost really fast. That was a plus. But if I did it again, which I don't plan to, I would do the coil contain, like in like cow panels or something. Like don't have the coil loose, like make like a panel with the coil in it that you could have a chain on it and pull the whole thing out with a tractor. You know what I mean? Like don't just spaghetti it into the pile, 'cause you're gonna damage it even with spades and shovels getting the pile apart. So where it really makes sense is people who are generating a lot of compost. Like if you're a commercial compost producer, okay, like you should probably think about that. And there is some companies now doing it where they have like the bays of compost, and on the walls they have a heat exchanger, and they're just getting some heat out of the walls of it. But it's not a system they have to embed in the compost pile, because the compost needs to, you know, you're really
Gotta
turning
be
a
working.
compost. Yeah. And if you're not turning it, it doesn't stay hot for very long. So, you know, it's one of those things that, like in permaculture, we and a lot of like ecological design, we get pretty enamored with just getting as many yields out of each thing as possible, and like maximizing each potential like harvest that might be in the system. But sometimes it's just not practical to do that, and you're just getting in the way of yourself. And it's like, hey, a compost pile just needs to be a compost pile, and a wood stove just needs to be a wood stove. So that was one of those lessons for me. It was like, don't mix it all together. So I don't, it wasn't worthwhile. You know, I'm not going to do it again, but I did learn a lot. I also learned that if the pump stops working for one cold night, the line going in from the tube to the greenhouse freezes. And then, you know, you're pouring boiling water on the line and trying to get it flowing again. You know, it's like, yeah, in the end,
So
not even needing the heat.
maybe for like a different climate or a different application, like you mentioned, like heating like wood or the flooring, you know, like
Yeah, I mean, if
that
you
could be cool.
if you're a cow farm, if you have lots of manure, or you're a wood chip arborist and you have a lot of or grass, you generate grass. If you generate heat by compost processes, and you could pump that into your slab in your house, yeah, you know, but it only takes a couple cords of wood with a good system to just heat your house too with a wood stove. That's like doesn't take a lot of like plump crazy plumbing and to do, you know.
So that's good to know. Thanks for sharing that experience.
Yeah. And that's really, I think, what's so great about this book. It's 20 years of you trying these ideas and seeing which are kind of pie in the sky and not actually practical, mm-hmm. and which are practical, like heating your water with mm-hmm. the with and obtaining that yield with the stove. So,
yeah, you know, like when I do tours here, people come like, oh, well, sometimes they're like, this is so cool to see all the things that work. It's like, well, they're only seeing, you know, a quarter of the stuff we've tried, you know.
No, right.
You're not really seeing all the stuff that didn't work.
Totally. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing all of your trials and your lessons with us and with our listeners. And is there anything that you're looking forward to coming up that you want to share, or things that you're looking ahead at the year?
I'm stoked to finish making a forge this winter. And nice. I'm actually taking charcoal out of my stove every few days to save up for it. And I always knew I wanted to make a forge for some years, but then it just fully occurred to me recently, like, oh my God, how am I not?
Yeah.
Forging metal, blacksmithing, it's like so baseline, so passive and so valuable. So I'm really stoked to start beating on some hot metal soon.
Awesome. Good for you.
That's great.
Yeah. And yeah, and
metalsmithing it up.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's it seems like low-hanging fruit. And yeah, just so like stoked for our annual permaculture course coming in the summer. We're going to try to do our reunion this year. We put it off from last year. It was just too busy of a summer. So we're going to hopefully announce that pretty soon and do that. And yeah.
In the kids program again this year, the kids camp?
I hope so. It was a heavy lift, but we've had to bring teachers in from far away and put them up. But maybe if we can get someone more local, it'll be more reasonable.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ben. And if folks want to learn more about you, remind them where to go.
Yeah, I would say go to the Whole System Design website. It's pretty updated these days, and you'll see our courses, and I'll have some books on there too for sale for a little while. And
awesome.
It's a good way to stay up to date.
Great.
Sweet.
Okay. Well,
thank you again.
Thank you again, and cheers.
Good to see you guys. Thanks a lot.
Good winter. Bye.